Hi, this is Randy Landry, and this is my 41st podcast of common-sense-in-america.com. Previously, it was Common Sense Ramblings in America, which I had posted on Buzzsprout. Now it's on my own blog. And you can find all my old postings from the last 5 years. All you have to do is go to category, podcasts, and they'll be all there, including all the new ones. Today I'm going to read from a more recent Imprimis article that was published in December of 2025, Volume 54, Issue 12. And it was written by McCubbin Thomas Owens. And it is entitled, The Dangers of Undermining U.S. Civil and Military Relations. I think that's kind of an appropriate article, and I'm going to read it without any further ado. A fundamental element of U.S. civil-military relations is the principle of civilian control of the military. This principle predates the Constitution itself. As Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, George Washington deferred to the Continental Congress, despite the severe disabilities of that body. The Constitution codified the principle of civilian control. Civilian policymakers would establish the goals of security policy and provide the material resources. The military would carry out the policy. If military leaders disagree with aspects of the policy, they can express their differences and make recommendations, but they have no right to insist that their advice be accepted. Civil-military relations are healthiest when there is mutual trust between civilians and the military, leading to a respectful give and take. Historians of civil-military relations often focus their attention on disputes between civilian policymakers and the military, judging healthy civil-military relations in terms of the numbers of times that one party or the other has its way. By this metric, the more often the civilians prevail, the healthier civilian or civil-military relations are assessed to be, at least until the presidency of Donald Trump. Donald Trump's first term, he and his military advisors clashed over such issues as our relationship with NATO, U.S. military actions in Afghanistan, intervention in Syria, and the appropriate response to domestic disorder. When his military advisors and Trump disagreed, the former frequently responded with subterfuge to undermine the president's ability to implement his agenda. Slow rolling, execution, leaking to the president, effort to undermine public confidence in the decision, or simply ignoring a policy. Bureaucracies have perfected these kinds of responses to policies with which they disagree, and those in the senior ranks of the military are often no different. But under Trump, the military employed these tactics to an unprecedented extent. Some went even further. For example, right after Trump's first inauguration, Georgetown Law Professor Rosa Brooks, a respected academic and senior Pentagon appointee from 2009 to 2011, wrote in Foreign Policy that Trump's first week as president has made it all too clear that he is as crazy as everyone feared. One possibility is that until recently I would have said was unthinkable to the United States of America, a military coup, or at least a refusal by military leaders to obey certain orders. Brooks continued that, for the first time, she could imagine plausible scenarios in which senior military officials might simply tell the president, "No, sir, we're not doing that." There is a name for this, praetorianism. From the time of Augustus Caesar until Constantine, a corps of soldiers known as the Praetorian Guard protected the Roman Emperor. Over time, the Praetorians became the real power in Rome, appointing and deposing emperors at will. In our time, Praetorianism has come to mean despotic military rule, something associated with countries in which the army is the real power behind the government. Praetorianism is incompatible with republican government. A modern failed example was the attempted coup against French President Charles de Gaulle in 1961, which arose from a Praetorian bent on the part of French officers who sought to depose him over his intentions to grant independence to Algeria. Seditious video. During his second term, many of Trump's political enemies have taken up where Rosa Brooks left off. Perhaps the most troubling example occurred recently when six Democrat members of Congress had posted a video aimed at service members. The video features U.S. Senators Elisa Slotkin of Michigan and Mark Kelly of Arizona, and U.S. Representatives Maggie Goodlander of New Hampshire, Jason Crow of Colorado, and Chris DeLuzio and Chrissy Houlihan of Pennsylvania, all of whom are either military veterans or former intelligence officials. In the video, the lawmakers remind active members of the military and national security community that they swore to protect and defend the U.S. Constitution. Right now, the threats to our Constitution aren't just coming from abroad, but from right here at home. DeLuzio, a former Navy officer, and Crow, a former Army Ranger and paratrooper, say in turn, Kelly, a former Navy captain, then says, "Our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders," which Slotkin, a former CIA officer, repeats. Crow then adds that military members must refuse illegal orders before the others say no one has to carry out orders that violate the law or our Constitution. And they all pledge that when service members refuse to carry out illegal orders, we have your back. Of course, regarding unlawful orders, these members of Congress are correct. All service members learn early in their training that they have an affirmative obligation to refuse unlawful orders. But service members do not get to refuse orders because they disagree with the administration's policies. And this video, at the very least, carelessly blurs the line between these things in a way to undermine trust between civilian policymakers and the military, and between seniors and subordinates within the military. The video was clearly political in nature and is likely to foster confusion within the military ranks. The lawmakers failed to identify any specifics regarding unlawful orders, nor did they offer examples of the kinds of orders soldiers should refuse to obey. Without context, the phrase refuse illegal orders blurs the line between legitimate legal instruction and political signaling. For a system that depends on discipline, clarity, and stability, ambiguity is a real problem. The civil-military implications are serious. Civilian control of the military rests on a clear hierarchy. Congress passes laws, the executive directs operations, and the military follows lawful commands. By addressing the troops directly about which orders to follow, the participants in the video disrupt that structure. Military leaders, not legislatures, are responsible for issuing guidance to troops on how to evaluate or report questionable orders. The seriousness of the issue is underlined by the fact that the video comes from politicians rather than military authorities. The video draws service members into a political dispute, sowing discord, which is especially dangerous during periods of political tension. The president and his supporters have called the video seditious. There have been suggestions that at least one of the lawmakers in the video, Senator Kelly, be called back to active duty to face a court-martial. Even some conservative lawmakers, such as Jonathan Turley and Andrew McCarthy, have argued that a sedition case would be dismissed immediately because those in the video were exercising their right to free speech. But one's right to oppose a policy does not extend to efforts to interfere with those obligated to execute that policy, which is the effect of the video, intended or not. The Civil War provides an analogous example. There were many people in the North who disagreed with President Lincoln's policies, but some Northern Democrats who came to be known as Copperheads crossed the line from a dissent to obstruction of the law effort by interfering with the recruitment and encouraging desertion. In 1863, anti-war Ohio Democrat Congressman Clement Vallandigham was arrested and tried by military tribunal for sabotaging the government's war policies. A group of war Democrats wrote to Lincoln, pledging support for the war but criticizing the prosecution of Vallandigham merely for his words. Lincoln replied that Vallandigham was encouraging desertion from the army, an act that is punishable by death. "Must I shoot a simple-minded soldier who deserts?" Lincoln asked. "While I must not touch a hair of a wily agitator who induces him to desert. There are some important similarities between the actions of the Copperheads and those of the participants in the recent video." When queried, the six lawmakers in the video weren't able to identify a single example of an unlawful order issued by Trump or his administration. That changed temporarily in late November when the Washington Post reported, citing anonymous sources, that Secretary of War Pete Hegseth had ordered an illegal second strike on a drug boat aimed at killing drug traffickers. Accusations of war crimes quickly dissolved, however, as the New York Times followed up with a story debunking the Post's account. And Admiral Frank Bradley, who himself ordered the Secretary, testified before Congress. Nonetheless, the question of the legality of military strikes on drug cartels remains a source of the claim that the Trump administration is operating outside the law. Another source for that claim is the administration's use of military force in cases of domestic disorder. In both cases, Trump's policies have historical precedents. Domestic disorder. Trump's critics claim that deploying National Guard and regular U.S. military forces to enforce the law in American cities violates civil military norms. It's unconstitutional and is irresponsible use of the professional military. But while there may be good reasons to limit the use of the U.S. military in domestic affairs, U.S. troops have been so employed since the beginning of our republic. Indeed, the U.S. Army Historical Center has published 300-400-page volumes on the use of federal military forces in domestic affairs. The authority of the president to use force in response to domestic disorder arises from the Constitution itself. Section 4 of Article 4 reads, "The United States shall guarantee to every state in this Union a republican form of government, and shall protect each of them against invasion, and on application of the legislature or the executive, when the legislature cannot be convened, against domestic violence." The fundamental purpose of a republican government is to protect its citizens' rights to life, liberty, and property. Although the First Amendment to the Constitution guarantees the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances, it does not protect riot, arson, and looting. Under Article 2 of the Constitution, the President, as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia when under federal control, has the authority to act against enemies both foreign and domestic. In 1792, Congress passed two laws pursuant to its constitutional power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. The Militia Act and the Calling Forth Act, which gave the President limited authority to employ the militia in the event of domestic emergencies. In 1807, at the behest of President Thomas Jefferson, troubled by his inability to use a regular army, as well as the militia to deal with the Aaron Burr conspiracy, to establish an independent country within the U.S., Congress passed the Insurrection Act. Although intended as a tool for suppressing rebellion when circumstances made it impractical to enforce the laws of the United States in any territory or state by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings, it also enabled the Army to enforce federal laws not only as a separate force, but also as a part of the local posse comitatus, a group conscripted to enforce the law. Accordingly, troops were often used in the antebellum period to enforce fugitive slave laws and suppress domestic violence. In 1854, President Franklin Pierce's Attorney General, Caleb Cushing, issued an opinion that endorsed the legality of using the army in a posse comitatus. A marshal of the United States, when opposed in the execution of his duty by unlawful combinations, has authority to summon the entire able-bodied force of his precinct as a posse comitatus. The authority comprehends not only bystanders and other citizens generally, but any and all organized armed forces, whether militia of the state or officers, soldiers, sailors, and Marines of the United States. Troops were used to suppress domestic violence between pro- and anti-slavery factions in Bloody Kansas, and federal soldiers and Marines participated in the capture of John Brown at Harper's Ferry in 1859. After the Civil War, the U.S. Army was involved in supporting the Reconstruction government in the southern states. Presidents invoked the Insurrection Act on five occasions during the 1950s and 60s to counter resistance to desegregation decrees in the South. And during the Los Angeles riots of 1982, elements of U.S. Army and Marine divisions augmented the California National Guard. Those who have criticized President Trump for the threatening to use the National Guard and possibly the Marines against the will of state governors might want to consider what happened when some Southern governors refused to execute the 1954 Supreme Court mandate to integrate schools. In 1957, Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus deployed his state's National Guard to defy federal authority of preventing integration of a high school in Little Rock. President Dwight D. Eisenhower responded by placing the Arkansas, Kansas National Guard under federal control and deploying soldiers of the 101st Airborne Division to enforce the law. In a letter to Eisenhower, Democrat U.S. Senator Richard Russell of Georgia compared soldiers of the 101st Airborne Division to Hitler's stormtroopers, illustrating that the argumentum ad hilarium often deployed against Trump is nothing new. Many today claim that Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 prohibits the use of the military in domestic affairs, but they completely misunderstand that law. In the election of 1876, President Ulysses S. Grant deployed Army units as a posse comitatus under the authority of local law enforcement officials to protect the rights of Black citizens and Republicans in general at Southern polling places. Excuse me. In that election, Rutherford B. Hayes defeated Samuel Tilden with the disputed electoral votes of South Carolina, Louisiana, and Florida. Southerners claimed that the Army had been misused to rig that election, which led to the passage of the PCA 2 years later. But the PCA only prohibits federal troops from being placed under lesser authorities than that of the president. It does not constitute a bar to the use of military in domestic affairs. And it certainly does not limit the president's authority as commander-in-chief in the U.S. military. As John Brinkerhoff, an authority on the use of military in domestic affairs, wrote in 2002, the president's power to use both regulars and militia remains undisturbed by the Posse Comitatus Act. Drug trafficking. Trump's critics charge him with violating both domestic and international law by using the U.S. military to target drug cartels and drug runners, claiming that his actions are unprecedented. But as far back as the Reagan administration in 1986, U.S. Army infantry and aviation assets operated with the Bolivian forces against drug producers in that country. In 1993, President Bill Clinton issued a presidential decision directive on counter-narcotics in the Western Hemisphere, assigning a substantial role in drug interdiction to the military. The National Defense Authorization Act of 1995 authorized use of military assets in drugs interdiction. 14 U.S.C. Sections 526 authorized firing on vessels carrying drugs, and 8 U.S.C. Section 1189 authorized the designation of a narcotic terror or narco terror groups as foreign terrorist organizations, unlocking powers used by every administration since 9/11. As for international law, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea authorizes military force against suspected stateless vessels engaged in piracy, slave trafficking, essentially labeling them hostis humani generis, meaning enemies of mankind. The Trump administration has proceeded in accordance with legal prudence. Admiral Alvin Halsey, commander of the U.S. Southern Command, properly sought legal justification for the strikes on suspected drug boats. Subsequently, the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel advised the Pentagon that the strikes were legal under both the U.S. and international law, and that all strikes had been conducted in complete compliance with the law of armed conflict, and that U.S. troops would not be exposed to prosecution for carrying out the orders. It is legitimate to argue that Trump's policy regarding these strikes is wrongheaded, but it is not unprecedented. Indeed, his interpretation of what constitutes the boundary of his military authority is historically ordinary. But what about the lack of congressional approval for the use of force against narco traffickers? In this regard, Trump's policy is comparable to the Obama administration's war in Libya and extensive drone attacks, the Biden administration's attacks on Houthi targets in Yemen, and indeed, going away back, President Jefferson's attack on the Barbary Pirates. All these were undertaken without congressional approval. Trump's actions in the Caribbean are well within the U.S. political norms. I am on record opposing the use of military in the war on drugs and the normalization of using U.S. forces in domestic law enforcement, but the fact is that President Trump has the constitutional and legal authority to do these things. Any arguments against his policies must be made in terms of prudence, not the Constitution or the law. Also, it should be needless to say, although today, sadly, it isn't, that opposition to Trump's policies should be expressed in a way that is careful not to undermine the principle of civilian control of the military that is fundamental to U.S. civil-military relations. Well, that concludes my reading from the Primus article. Hope you found it interesting. It just seems like because Trump is doing it, it's bad. Obama, Biden, Clinton, Bush, if they did it, it was good. It's just all part of the Trump derangement syndrome. It's also, I think, more than that. It's also about the fact is that the Democrats want power back. They have, some of them, maybe not all of them, want to destroy this country. I don't know why they want to go back to socialism, why they seem to think that they can maintain power in a socialistic government, and why some of these companies that were going against Trump, President Trump in his first term of office, thinking that they would be able to keep themselves afloat, basically, or in power once the United States fell and became a communist country. They now look at what's happened in China and all that, how corporations are just taken over by the federal government. I guess not. So, I don't know. But what I do know is one thing, and that is we have to get our shit together, basically, and stop all this crap going on in this country. And I think the Insurrection Act needs to be enforced. Basically, martial law in certain areas, pretty much. And we also need to get rid of the filibuster so we can just get some of these laws that he's written executive orders on passed through Congress. Mainly the one that requires voter registration and ID to vote. Simple enough. And pretty much every country in the world requires those. At least any ones that are trying to maintain a halfway decent country. But yet, we don't want to do that. Why? Because there's a lot of corruption going on. A lot of cheating going on in these elections. It's been shown that in several of the elections previous in the last couple decades, the Democrats did not actually win. The elections were stolen. So, mail-in ballots, only in the case of infirmity or overseas, should be allowed, not just for convenience. Also, election day should be a national holiday, okay? Where, with all possibility, places should be closed, allowing for time to vote. Now, of course, hospitals and fire departments and police stations like that can't, but they don't work 24 hours either a day. And if we do not allow extended voting, then at least only allow it for those people that have to work. You know, there are always exceptions, but just mass mail-in ballots is not the way to go. So I guess that about covers it for today. One thing more is my hearts go out to all the Iranians that have been killed by their government. And in this case, I'm not sure why President Trump is waffling. He didn't waffle much when it came to Venezuela. I think we could decapitate the government, take out the leaders, and put them in jail for crimes against humanity. And that would be all she wrote. And a lot of people to self-govern. Or at least set up themselves with people that are living more. I don't know. The problem is they've been fighting this crap for thousands of years. And they believe in Sharia law, some of these countries and all this shit. You're not going to change them. And, okay, so maybe you get a halfway decent ruler in office. And when that person dies or whatever is replaced, you're going to get some asshole that's going to be just as bad as what you had in that before. They just, I don't know, they're just going to have problems. It's just the way it is. And maybe we should just get ourselves out of there and let them go at it. But The problem is we have Israel that's stuck right smack dab in the middle. I mean, we have Venezuelan oil, we have American oil, and then if we get part of Canada to move into the United States, we certainly have all the shale up there. So we have more than enough oil to get us through the next 100 years. And maybe by then we'll have some alternate source of energy that actually do work. All right, without any further ado, I'm going to call it a day. And you have, as always, watch your back, watch your six. And don't give up on the fight. Well, take care.